Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Art and Labor. It's a podcast about art and a podcast about labor.
We're a podcast on the ongoing struggle to survive as art and or cultural workers. I am OK Fox.
And I'm Lucia Love.
And we have three guests in our little studio today. We did it.
Yeah, nobody really knows how big our studio is, but if you can
like
close your
tesseract.
Eyes. Yeah, go on a little visual journey with us for a second. You could like reach your arm out and then reach your other arm out and almost touch the walls.
It's just all white. It's rows and rows of Macintoshes. Yeah. As far as you can see, glass overlooking the city.
It's just like beautiful. We collapsed time and space to get six people to fit in this room.
Oh, yeah, definitely. But really, you could touch the walls. So, yeah, we have three guests here. Would you all like to introduce yourselves?
Sure. I'm Chris Hay.
Gary Murphy.
I'm Rob Kaiser Schatzlein.
And y'all are a part of the union, and you're at PS1. You're all in the art handling department?
Yeah, that's right. We're all part of the bargaining unit. We're negotiating a contract now, and the three of us are representing all the art handlers. There's like almost 30 of us in total. We're... All the three of us sit in on the meetings with management and discuss what the contract should look like. It's interesting because none of us are full time, so trying to figure out a contract of what can work with management and art handlers, it's not like a normal contract that most people have.
Yeah, but it's not unprecedented at the same time. Like the Teamsters that work for television and film similarly are working unorthodox hours.
Totally. Yeah.
In many different studios. And so it's, you know,
and those Teamsters. Those Teamsters are also not Teamsters. I'm sorry. None of them are driving any horses or cattle.
My problem.
I have a problem with the nomenclature.
Those Teamsters. Like Local One. I was just thinking about like the Local One contracts in like the Broadway contracts, the stagehand guys.
Yes, the stagehand.
Because it was always sort of a joke. I worked in theater for a long time too, and it was like always a joke, like how much they got paid, how much like the union guys got paid, these like really fat contracts. And they do, like some of them make almost like $100 an hour, like running light op boards and stuff. Mm-hmm. And then, but it's because they've just been unionized for so long.
Yeah.
Like I think they were unionized like back in the 20s. So you have like these built-in rate increases every single year, and you know, bada bing, bada boom. Now you're making like $100 an hour, and I was like, I'm absolutely positive that if they tried to unionize now, and they like were like, okay, you got to pay us, you know, $90 an hour plus benefits, and you know, an hour brunch, lunch break, and they would just say we can't afford it.
Oh,
you know what I mean? There's like
way. We're just struggling to get by.
Yeah, the poor like how, like oh, it's a it's theater. They'd be like, it's theater. We can't, you know,
it's
we can't pay somebody. Yeah.
That's like something we're always unpacking on this podcast is the idea of a labor of love.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. We all work for dreams and we survive on dreams. And I've given up needing money, actually.
It goes back to, you know, some of our first episodes were about the Art Workers Coalition. Back in the 60s, and a lot of those folks were, you know, like organizing at like MoMA back in the day. And what was it? It's we can't eat prestige. That was their
2110
slogan.
Used that in their last.
Yes. Yeah. That, exactly. Listeners to us might remember our episode where we interviewed folks at the 2110 picket line outside of the MoMA's annual gala. You might remember us talking about how PS1 isn't actually a part of that
different
union.
Different union.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think maybe y'all can speak a little more eloquently as to the details of your bargaining that and the comparison between the institutions that you've been trying to illuminate for people.
Well, 2110 is at MoMA, but also Local 30, which is what we're part of, is also at MoMA.
But they're the art handlers at MoMA.
Or? Well, they're the painters, the art handlers, mm-hmm. the carpenters, the engineers, lighting.
Maintenance.
Maintenance, which is generally under building engineers, which is Local 30. So our contract covers, at PS1, it covers the art installers as well as the maintenance workers. So we do have a full-time presence as part of our contract. And what we're comparing is the art installers who have a separate contract at Local 30. Like all the different departments have separate contracts and get paid differently. And actually the art handlers at MoMA get paid the least of all of the Local 30 members. And we don't really even know what other people are getting paid, but we have some idea because people that have worked at PS1, you know, do freelance stuff for other departments at MoMA, so we know a little bit about what's going on there. But at PS1, the art installers are paid significantly less than the art installers are paid at MoMA. So, and we're doing work like painting, carpentry, lighting, AV. So we're not even trying to tack our rate to those people who are getting paid on a whole more than the art handlers are getting paid at MoMA, which is complicated. But so we're just trying to get paid as much as the art handlers do at MoMA, which is about 50% more than we make their highest level of pay. So, and it's likely, it's kind of what Chris was talking about. It's because they've been unionized longer, so their rate has been tacked to cost of living adjustments for a longer period. And most people haven't really seen a bump in their wages probably in the last 30 years, if not the last 50. So our wages make sense to most people in the industry because their wages have never gotten tacked to cost of living adjustments, you know, a 2 or 3% increase at most. So most people have been making like $25 an hour for 10 years or more. And so our top rate is $30 an hour right now, which a lot of people have been making for probably 10 years at the upper level of the art handling world. But if it had been tied to cost of living adjustments, and it hadn't been such a marginalized, specialized trade, it probably would be closer to $40, $45 an hour. Whereas, like, you know, if you're a carpenter in the business and you're unionized, 50 is like kind of the standard entry level if you're credentialed. So for us, we're trying to get our rate up to a level kind of where it should be based on inflation. And yeah, we're and using their rate as our standard.
And it's also extremely specialized, sometimes dangerous, and like work with extremely valuable objects. Yeah. You know, it just there's a lot of folks who listen to us who maybe aren't familiar with art handling. If you guys want to get into what your day-to-day entails.
Well, I'll just say that it's new. It's definitely newer than like carpentry or lighting even. And if you watch videos of people handling art at auctions from the 70s, it's just like the janitor with a cigarette in his mouth, you know, just like grabbing a Rothko with one hand and walking out of the room. Yeah. And so our field is very similar to a line of work like all those other ones I've mentioned, like carpentry, where it takes a lot of technical skill and you have to know how to use tools and stuff like that. But it's just newer and the art world hasn't had ever in America as much money as it's had now. So
seems like it's also a little bit performative, or that like there's a public face to the art handling community, where maybe like if sometimes like you could be setting up a showroom or something, so you're kind of expected to be sort of put together in a different way than someone who's just like a carpenter. So you have to know all of the skills but also have like a palatability to you.
You gotta have like the right shirt.
Some jobs you do. I know definitely one job that's in Midtown. It's like a high level gallery. You have to wear, you know, business clothes. But most of them you don't. I have to look. It's not that specialized. It's just like
you're supposed to look a certain way, Rob.
I know. That's why I don't make the top rates.
Yeah, art handlers are models.
Well, I mean, one of the things is it's so hard to describe art handling, and so few people know about it because contemporary art is so diverse in the materials that you use. So, like, a carpenter is always using wood, or you know, like the stoneworker is always using stone. We use plastic and tape and all this stuff. But what you're doing, especially at PS1, which is a contemporary art institution, is different every time. So explaining to people what you do is like, I don't know. And you know, if you ask someone on the street or like your mom, like, what is contemporary art? They'd have no way to describe it in a sentence or two. So that, you know, feeds into part of the marginalization of our work, is that it's not really clear what we do. And we can't say, you have to know how to use this saw, you have to know how to use this thing, and I had to do this training, it took this number of hours, I did this credentialing, you have to pay me XYZ. Or, like, you know, if you're a doctor,
you have to be a jack of all trades. Yeah, you have to be versatile. And it also depends on the museum, how many people are going to be on your team, and all sorts of stuff.
It matters like so much. Which is not valued in the industry is longevity at a certain museum or a gallery or something, because you know the idiosyncrasies of that museum or gallery, and you start to, because it is sort of like specific. There are some universal things that you pick up, and how something's supposed to be handled and certain language, but really, it's like you need to know what's behind every wall, and you need to know like how certain curators like things, like what temperature lights they like, and all these things, and where everything's kept.
Yeah, how the walls move. Exactly. Everything's hidden kind of behind certain walls. Storage is different.
And that's not valued. And it's like, this is like throughout the industry, it's not valued at all. So then people just sort of float around because they're, you know, they don't get paid anymore for staying somewhere longer. And then there's no understanding of like how long it takes to train somebody. And it's like, this isn't even in the worker's interest necessarily. It's like in the actual museum or gallery's interest to keep people around. Like, this is just like makes financial sense. It's just kind of like some, like, good managing, and they just don't do it. It's really bizarre. It just doesn't make any sense.
But I mean, what we're experiencing is that the industry is kind of maturing, and so there's a lot of people now who've been, you know, there's a lot of people who go through art handling very quickly because it's a job you can get after you go to art school, and you know how to hang a painting because you've made a painting, you know about like how strong stretcher bars are because you've, you know, made stretcher bars, and you know how durable the surface of an acrylic painting is because you've made an acrylic painting, or, you know, you know how to deal with plaster or something like that.
Wait, did you all go to art school?
Yeah, I went to art school.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah.
For the most part. Yeah, and I think, you know, a lot of, not everyone has, you know, but a lot of people have, because you can learn a lot of the stuff on the job. But for artists, it's a kind of job, but people don't think of it like, you know, maybe an 18-year-old whose parent was a carpenter would think about becoming a carpenter, like, oh, maybe I won't go to school, I'll just join the union and be a carpenter. But it's now, I think, turning into a job where people might do it for their lifetime, be an art handler, whereas it's still pretty much considered a job where people do it like 10 years and then hopefully...
Or fall into it accidentally.
They fall into it. A lot of people into it accidentally, kind of like construction jobs. And then they'll move on. Hopefully, you know, their art career will take off, or they'll get another job, or they'll move upstate or something like that. We're part of the group of people who are trying to turn it into a formalized part of the economy, and part of our negotiation has to do with what is the value of our labor in very, you know, simple economic terms. And there's no way to compare it to anything. You know, there's institutions that have never been unionized and the rates are really low. There's people who are unionized and they're really high, and, you know, there's not much between that. So we're kind of dealing with this process of formalizing the economy. And, you know, eventually there will be more standards, and, you know, it'll be similar to these organized trades.
Yeah, there was that we went to Chicago a few months ago, and we had a round table open discussion with people about what a unionized art world would look like. One of the issues that came up during this conversation was that There were many art workers who felt like their jobs were not well defined, and, and you were mentioning this as well, like that we are expected to have these sort of generalized knowledge bases, and we're not expected to become like masters in any craft, because at any point you can get picked up and put on some other job, and you have to just be able to sort of like go with the flow of things. But yeah, I wonder if there is any move in the community to start like having the lighting person be a specific sort of subset of the crew, or have their like actually be a plaster person, or someone who is more like acclimated to polymers or something, if you have to like touch up a painting, or you know, or is everyone just like always gonna?
There definitely is. I mean, we sort of have taken it on ourselves to do that.
But PS1 is definitely it's gone from being just total like everyone does everything, to becoming more formalized. I mean, it's really like tracking how things have become specialized.
But it's kind of, we sort of taken that on ourselves, like the workers have sort of taken that on, and there's a lot of, I mean,
no doubt, yeah.
we've gotten pushback in the room. They really don't want people to have any kind of title that specializes them, and maybe I have some theories about why not, you know. And I think,
I mean, I'll say it was like that even in art publishing, like when I was at Artform, I wrote my own job description when I was hired. Like it's like,
like, it seems like they just don't have any money at Art Forum, though, to pay anyone. And they're like, yeah, make your own hat.
It's like, it's just like bizarre. I mean, it's just like these like art organizations just kind of fly by the seat of their pants. And it's like maybe at one point people were in situations where they like could live off those salaries and like didn't really care about, in like, you know, whatever bullshit structural problems there were. But now I guess we're at a point where rent is so high and wages have just stagnated for so long that everyone's just fucking sick of it, and like and nothing is like, everything's cracked,
and the economy is just so big too. There's just so many so many galleries and museums and stuff that there's just a lot more of us, because I'm sure that there was always people that were struggling and working the arts. They probably just left really soon, and then there was a fresh influx of recent graduates that were like 20 years old and like would work for free.
I'm just happy to be here.
Yeah, exactly. The internship thing. And then also people with like inherited wealth that could afford to live in New York City and like work for a while.
And but, that's what they're looking for. All these places, like they're always looking for somebody who's just like, their parents pay their rent, so they're not going to complain about their salary, you know?
Yeah, but the truth is that the quality remains really low too.
Right.
You know? And I think that's the kind of one that should be one of the final arbiters too, because you don't get something, you know, and that's what we can see at MoMA, like they've unionized.
Yeah.
They need the quality to be a lot higher. They have a lot more, you know, more people coming through there and a higher expectations. Whereas PS1, the building is falling apart. I mean, it's literally falling apart. And they've been able to get away with a lower quality product for a long time because they were kind of seen as like an upstart institution, and a lot of people cared, but it wasn't like the kind of finish you would get at other places that would pay their workers better. And that's what happens when you pay your workers better, you get a better product. And you know, with more interest in the art world, more money coming in, people care about things being nicer and better functioning. And so one of the results is that people start asking for better wages because they start to care about the work more. And that's largely what's happened with us, is that we've started to take more pride in our work and care more. And then that actually becomes a problem for management.
How do you see that problem developing? Because I'm sure it's like a crucial aspect of negotiations when you can understand like the institution's issues with.
Just one thing that's sort of to this point is that as they want to, sort of have a better quality or a better product. More is expected of us. And so they're sort of using this, arguing two sides of like the same point where they're like, well, you guys need to start doing better work. But then also,
so that we don't send in contractors to do your work for you.
So that which exactly, they've done. Exactly. Hire outside contractors to do our work because like you guys aren't capable of it, even though we are, we just need the time to do it. But then also, you guys, we're not going to pay you anything because remember in the old days, you guys would work for like really cheap and you'd work all night and
yeah, it's all for the love.
Yeah, because you like what, you know, remember that? That's in the DNA of PS1. That's the way this institution is founded on like just heart and blood and sweat and like so.
Leftovers from the 70s too.
Totally.
Oh, we were totally. All scrappy.
Yeah, we were all living in a bunker in Soho.
Yeah. Well, just go be a squatter. It'll be more real.
But there is like there's a way like you could get if you can inspire people, you can totally inspire people to work for a lot cheaper, like do a lot more for a lot less. It's just you just have to be really inspiring.
That's terrible. Yeah. Or manipulative.
Yeah.
It's also like the vibe at PS1 and that whole neighborhood has changed because of PS1. When I was a teenager, PS1 was $2 across the board, no matter who you were. Like, and now it's, you know, there are seven different tiers of payment.
Isn't it still suggested donation?
Yes. Yeah.
I mean,
free,
yeah.
Yeah.
It's still free, yeah. But it's like, have you seen that, that lobby that's all on the front? That, like, wasn't like that, like, 10 years ago.
The bookstore?
Yeah, that wasn't, none of that was there.
Yeah.
Like, it's building.
Nice,
yeah, I mean, what I'm saying is they have invested so much into this space. Yeah. They are earning so much more from this space. That neighborhood is insanely wealthier in general. They can afford to pay you guys more.
Oh yeah,
than
yeah.
back yeah, in exactly. the day yeah, or yeah. whatever.
Has Amazon approached PS1
I'm sure.
to do a crossover yet?
I'm sure they're. I don't know anything.
The thing that I've heard is that Amazon
sure,
is.
They're going to have some Amazon. Events.
Amazon is going to subsidize artists' studio spaces in that area, and anybody who takes those spaces is a fucking scab. It needs to be blacklisted.
Oh my god! All the Castle Braid people are going to move.
They're
going to
take it. The Castle. Yes, that is such a good prediction. That you heard it here first. That's going to happen. Oh my god!
Who were they?
They are some like jokester adult baby people. They're like run a hotel in Bushwick.
Like
literally,
actually adult babies.
Like, not like the fetish. Okay. But,
well,
like,
it was a joke.
That's an interesting hotel.
But like you know, stunted adulthood. Like oh, you know, we're just Peter Pans. I don't know.
Yeah, like the internet was you know they were blowing up about Castle Braid because it's like the epitome of Bushwick and.
Wait, are these the blockchain guys?
Blockchain? No. This is like they're like, ooh, look, I welded a bunch of weird scraps of metal together, and that's my sculpture. Like, oh, I'm creative. And then someone else is like, I have a coffee company. I'm also an artist, but the
WeWork coffee or a WeWork artist space or something.
Totally. And that so
Good
the
idea.
Internet blew up.
Thank you, Chris.
we create.
Oh god.
Multi-purpose.
Yeah. And everyone was like, y'all are just like adult babies over there, aren't you? And they were like, no, we're not. Look at what we can do. We made ourselves our own seesaw on the roof.
Oh. That convinced me.
Yeah.
It's just some classic Bushwick rich artist bullshit.
Yeah.
Just overly moneyed garbage, just in the middle of just like a normal working class street. Like it's like it's not like it's in like a defunct warehouse. It's like it's so gross. It's like. It's bad to look at. Don't look at it. I'm wondering if has any of you heard of Art Handler magazine?
Yeah.
Have you any of you been featured?
No.
No. They came to PS1.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought that they were jokesters. I thought that they're. I thought it was.
Oh, they were like filming you do something.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. And I totally thought they were mocking me.
Mm. It's like
because they were like, "Oh, I'm Art Handler Magazine," and they were like filming us build something. Yeah. And I was like, "Dude, come on."
It seemed I was trying to get
me while I do my job.
Yeah,
but then they were
paperwork
serious
for
about
that.
It. Yeah.
I was just wondering what that thing is all about, because to me it's like it just seems like a very trendy Instagram, and I'm like, does it organize art workers? Like, I don't know.
Oh, like who actually funds
I don't know.
It
I'm just
and what? It's a physical paper.
Oh. I think they've been supportive of something, but I don't know.
Yeah.
Oh, so they actually write articles?
I think so.
Wait, yeah. Wait, you've been to their site?
Yeah.
Oh, I've been to their site.
I think it's a real thing.
Yeah. I've been to their Instagram.
No, it's a real. I saw the issue. They did a whole.
Cool. Yeah. One of my friends writes for them.
Oh, neat. I have to get the magazine then, because I just thought it was a trendy Instagram.
No, it's actually really cool. They've got some deep reads.
Mm, I'm sure that I've read something from there and just forgot that it was from there.
Well, how about the Art Handlers Alliance? Do you guys know?
Oh, I spoke to some of them a couple years ago, back when I was a packer at Artform, because I was like, this is a weird job with, we were all on, I was like pretty young, and I didn't really know what to do. And I was just like, you know, we're all on 1099s, but we can't set our rate and we can't set our hours. And it's kind of demanding, like there's a bunch of 50 pound boxes and like each magazine's like 3 pounds, and like it's like you do like a lot a day, and it's a lot of like physical labor, and then we have no sick pay or like no workers comp if you're hurt, which had happened. Yeah. And so I was just like, I remember like reaching out to them on Facebook a couple of years ago, and they do little like open bar events, like come meet us things.
Your rights, about like labor stuff.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Cause I was just like, what can I do?
Like, so did that change? Are they W-2 now?
It did change. Yeah. While I got hired full time there, they got audited. Someone from the Department of Labor came by.
Yeah. It is illegal. There's still some galleries that a lot of galleries do that.
And I told my stepmom about this, who works in publishing, and she's like, oh, they all do that.
Yeah,
they all, like, for like any physical like, you know, like books or magazines, they all do those illegal 1099s.
No, I mean, like, every business wants, you know, just wishes, you know, they go home and they pray by the bedside every night that all their employees will wake up the next morning and all their employees will be 1099, you know, like from the C-suite down. And you know, you really see in the areas of the economy where there isn't much money flowing through it that it just kind of remains. And then if it gets some kind of influx of capital, then people start getting fed up and doing something about it. But, I mean, the best thing for the art world would be, one, getting everyone off 1099s,
yes.
And then, two, getting everyone unionized. God. Because a lot of people are losing a lot of money. And, and people are making, like, $25 an hour on a 1099, which is, you're essentially, you know, you're losing, like, 15% of that right off the bat.
Yeah, because I would have to pay my taxes, and I would have to, like, keep like a couple $1,000 and just not touch it, because I would just get screwed over, and like, oh my God, it was a nightmare.
Yeah. I mean, you essentially, you pay your taxes and then you also pay 15%.
Yeah.
So it's funny. I feel like we're just like a couple years behind the theater world, because when I moved in 2008, and somewhere in the mid 2000s, there was a bunch of, everybody, all the downtown theaters got audited. So almost everybody was W-2'd, but they all, within the past like 2 years, they'd all switched to W-2s. And before that, they all 1099. So there's kind of like massive campaign.
Well, I mean, usually what happens is that you've got someone working on 1099 at a gallery, say, as a freelance, working 5 days a week or something like that. They get fired or laid off or something like that. They claim unemployment, and then that's it, you know? So that's happened to a couple of galleries that I've worked for, and now most of the galleries I work for put you on a W-2, but that means they have to pay you unemployment. So in a way, it would be really good for a lot of people, but people don't take the unemployment.
Yeah,
but
everyone's got to take unemployment. It's also a way to
keep people honest. We've said this many times on this podcast.
People honest.
Yeah. But I mean, it would be good, because like for our job, it's it's good that we're on a W-2, but it's better that we're unionized because we can take unemployment. And I mean, you know, something like 85% of the film industry is unemployed at any given time.
Yes, I was just about to say that. Everybody I know who works in TV and film, between jobs, they go on unemployment.
Yeah.
That is just industry standard. People
so I think
that.
That's kind of what we're moving
the
towards.
The same with theater, too. That's
yeah, what yeah. I was seeing
I was so
prior to that.
I was so surprised. It was, you know, there's a couple things that were different about the culture and the nobody went on unemployment. I was like, that's just, yeah. And the theater, like, you worked on the show, and then when it opened, you went on unemployment for a couple of weeks until you worked on another one or until a strike or whatever, you know?
I mean, that's how it should be. I mean, if we're, you know, like, if that's the way schedules have to be, then, like, yes, I mean, that's, it makes sense if you think about it. It's like, what are, like, do you really just want, what are people supposed to do? Like,
so somebody, somebody was like, unemployment, the real endowment for the arts.
Nice.
That's cool.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe they should rebrand it, call it something else.
Yeah, yeah.
I just wonder how sustainable all of this stuff is when you hear people talk about their organizations out of like Los Angeles and talk about like SAG and the difficulties they have keeping things together that have been so long running. And just like if there is pressure in the organizations that have already like had a proven track record to like raise the quality of our creative output and like support a lot of artists in their various fields, then like, you know, ideally from our perspective, it's like, hell yeah, like let's just all do the thing that works. But there seems to be some kind of like larger economic trends that are just like, we don't like this though, and we just want to keep attacking the things that are like actually supporting people. And I wonder about those, like the flip side of that coin, or if it's even worth like looking at. I don't know.
Wait, what do you mean? Or could you clarify? I guess I
see it as like, yes, this is very logical. If we have these project-based work schedules and then we have unemployment in between these times, that's great because then we're all being taken care of on a consistent basis. But then when you look at people who are like, I'm a union buster and I really don't even like the ones that exist. And I think that we need to go into like a, you know, more like free market. And a lot of those moves, like currently we see a lot of labor rights dissolving.
Right.
You know,
across the country.
Yeah.
I mean, they're like, barely, they've been so deteriorated that I feel like we're living in that reality now as far as not really having unions.
Oh, yeah. We're definitely.
And it's just this free market, whatever that means.
But I wonder if that like affects strategy, because if we have, you know, if we have like an increase of right to work states and we have this sort of like push to keep more of our workforce on a freelance basis. And, you know, we're turning different economies into piecemeal work that never were before.
I wanted to phrase it a different way, meaning, so like, you know, the taxi workers, cab workers, you know, for decades and decades and decades had really strong union. How do we prevent some fucking
disruptor
from coming in here and then just stripping it all away again?
Just making things like really efficient. You mean just like
nice for the customer?
Yeah, yeah.
Or like, you know,
Amazon just killing everything.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that, you know, it's specialized in a way that, and it's small enough of a market that I'm not sure actually if it's something to be worried about.
Yeah, I know, but I think that's
financialization of art handling. But I think the economy is so small compared to that of taxi drivers that I'm not worried about it. And I think that in terms of, you know, freelancing, I'm in the art world, freelancing is pretty much standard because the art world essentially was developed after the 1970s, after the breakdown of, you know, major corporations, conglomerations. And, you know, we've been living in what is just a thoroughly freelance economy. And yeah. I think that for us, it's about figuring out how to support freelance workers through like portable benefits and through more lenient unemployment laws and other things that support freelancers as it, and accepting that it is kind of a permanently gigged economy. And but that doesn't mean that businesses don't have obligations to their employees if their employees aren't full-time.
Right. Yeah.
So it's kind of changing the way, and I think we're kind of on the vanguard of that in New York City because there's so many businesses crammed together at once. So it's actually possible to carve out a kind of full-time freelance
work,
and make, you know, a lot of people can make like six figures doing freelance, especially in other jobs, you know, other like consulting jobs. We just have to figure out a way that it can work for people. Yeah, I mean, we just have to figure out a way that
the gig economy, I mean, part of it is, it's in the, it benefits the owners because they don't want to pay benefits. And then, but it also benefits the workers too, because a lot of us are artists that have a practice of some sort. So there's a lot of musicians, a lot of writers, a lot of painters, filmmakers.
I feel for the workers who are doing like kind of the same art handling gigs, but at smaller galleries and not, you know, household name institutions. And so I'm also thinking about them and like their shitty ass contracts and how do we reach out to them and stuff like that.
But, well, they don't even have, I mean, you have to build something in order to, like, we just got a contract 2 years ago and we're at MoMA.
Yeah.
And so there wasn't, I feel like, we should build, some sort of coalition.
Yeah, it's definitely about getting those people to know their rights so they are not on 1099s. Yeah. And then also, you know, if you use the comparison with the film world, you know, a lot of smaller films are made non-union. And that's just kind of how it works. And I don't know if that's okay or not, but you get paid a lot less, and so people don't work those jobs as long. And I think that it worked for some people, and maybe that's okay, maybe it's not. I'm not sure. But especially the smaller galleries, you know, some of them actually take care of their workers. So, you know, maybe that'd be okay.
Yeah, yeah. But just because like, you're in a small gallery doesn't mean...
Yeah, working in a museum, you know, they have tools. Mm-hmm. They have really, you know, heavy-duty, you know, $10,000 saws and stuff like that, and really specialized labor. And, you know, the apparatus is so much larger and so much more complicated. And trying to do it without a union is proven to be like impossible.
I guess what I was trying to work towards is like thinking of the way that unions operate in a larger economy where, like, if you look back into the 30s and you see, like, a lot of the stuff that FDR put through, and you just say, like, oh, okay, so there was, like, a Wagner Act or whatever. There was, like, all this stuff that, like, the government decided that would stimulate the economy by ensuring that the workers had excess income to use in their communities. And so there was like a lot of labor laws that put into place, and there was a lot of support for this stuff. And I think it's just kind of a different time to be operating and trying to build a union in a structure that is openly hostile to the idea that these groups should exist at all.
So you're talking about messaging, like are we living in an age that's hostile to labor?
Yeah, exactly. And really like, strange, and like, how do we talk about that in a way where it's like, cause I hear you say like portable benefits and stuff. And I'm like, no, that's completely insane. Like we shouldn't have these sort of, you know, concessions. We should be saying like, I should just be able to go to the doctor.
Housing and healthcare taken care of.
Yeah.
And then we wouldn't be fighting so much about wages. I mean, you still fight for wages, but if you had housing and healthcare, I don't know, it'd be more negotiable. But now it's like, no, no, we have, like, we're going to fight tooth and nail for every dollar because we can't go to the doctor or we can't afford to live. Like, yeah. We'll literally be literally. Kicked out of our apartment and move out of the city. So you kind of almost have nothing to lose. They kind of, like they've gotten labor, their backs up against the wall so much.
It's
in
like,
this
we're
city.
Some of your best people. We've been with you for 15 years. We can't afford to live in this city anymore.
Yeah.
So
not
we can't.
Forget about the neighborhood. You know, no. Yeah. Like, we've given, you know, I feel like that, yeah, that fight was given up years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're not living in any neighborhood where you work in the art. Like, no workers. Living in Chelsea, or no art handler.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, we were thinking about that on a different episode. So, when we were talking about you know, MoMA and why people aren't, you know, picketing MoMA or the Whitney or the Guggenheim more often. I think part of it is because people aren't in close proximity to those museums as much. And people.
Oh, that's interesting.
We just like don't even go to Manhattan anymore.
Yeah,
yeah. So all of the whole island can
we gave
just,
it up to the wealthy.
Yeah.
Also, I feel like it's just not, we just grew up sort of expecting and accepting wealth, like.
Bad prospects.
Yeah, but also wealth just like bubbling in these like very, like pocketing in these. In these specific places. I mean, like, look at our president. He was like, but he's heralded. Like, I would think people would throw rocks at him. He's like some asshole billionaire. It's like Jeff Bezos. I was just listening. He's like getting divorced or whatever, you know.
Yeah,
sorry to him and his
and
family.
And Mackenzie is going to become the richest woman
and
in
was
the
it? They have like $60 billion or something.
Each,
what is it?
Yeah. Well, that's how much she would get, half of
she
his
she would
wealth.
Get $60 billion.
Yeah.
So like, how anybody doesn't hear that? Like, people are like, oh, wow, does she deserve $60 billion? And
no.
It's like, well, obviously not.
Neither of them
neither
do.
Of them,
yeah, yeah. Like, no, I mean, nobody does.
Nobody.
So, there's something sick in the system that their worker, that isn't redistributed in some way.
And it's almost like people really do want to believe in the benevolent billionaire, whether it's Bill Gates or even if it's like people are like, oh, yeah, we're rooting for Jeff Bezos because he's fighting Trump, and it's just like I picked my billionaire and he's the good billionaire.
Yeah.
Like billionaire cage fight.
But just pointing out, like, no, that's that there's something wrong with with the system that that allows that to happen, obviously. But in the arts, I was like, you know, in our socialist utopia where everybody is paid a living wage and healthcare and housing is taken care of, that we still there's like some sort of lottery system for like billionaires, so you can still have the eccentric billionaire. Like, but they wouldn't be able to have their wealth passed on. But there's something fun about like just seeing what happens to the human mind when it comes under the pressure of just like immense wealth. That
what
each
if everyone
generation
gets to take a turn being the billionaire.
Oh, that's fun. Yeah. A lot, like 5 years or something. That's even better.
I didn't expect you guys to be so imaginative.
Hello. I think it's important for us to consider then like the system that allows people to become billionaires, because they're all the people who are like supporting the arts also. And it's just like, how do we think of a system that has gotten us to this point where like everyone is allowed to amass incredible amounts of wealth and then park it in the arts as a sort of like tax haven for themselves. And then we're like trying to bring some equity or equanimity to the environment. And we're trying to say like, oh, we should, you know, we should be bargaining with these people. But like the whole thing is fundamentally run on the concepts of like libertarian free market excess.
Right.
And I don't expect anyone to have an answer to that, but it's
well,
just like,
I think
whoa.
That, I mean, one of the things that we're dealing with is that, going back to what you're saying about labor laws from the 1930s, is that we're dealing with, especially in the art world, is a very new economy, and we're trying to figure out how to fit that in. And everyone else is doing this too, but we're trying to fit that into really outdated labor laws that largely apply to manufacturing, and that were, you know, really obscure laws are exploited by like the United Mine Workers and eventually by UAW to create, you know, laws that could work for everyone, like, you know, outlawing child labor and making sure we had a weekend and stuff like that. And you know, tacking which
is,
pay to...
Which is really good to, like, remember that that wasn't always the way it was. Like, when people think about what the possibilities of what, how much you can get, or just, like, what a wage should be, it's important to remember that people had to fight for child labor laws and for a weekend
overtime
and for overtime and all these things were like it wasn't generously given to the worker by by any sort of corporation or business or anything. This was like in the streets.
The history of UAW is completely insane, like the stuff that they went through with GM.
It's totally nuts.
Yeah, I just keep thinking of just like...
It's an amount of organization and social cohesion around an idea that we can't even really imagine today. I mean, everything is so fractured in terms of social movements that at that time, you know, it was incredibly effective. And if we're thinking about a new labor movement, we're just beginning or something, you know? And I think especially in the art world, we're just beginning because the possibilities are... endless, but I think like we're just waking up to it. And something that I was talking about with Chris on the phone the other day was that, you know, even a year ago, we weren't even thinking, we kind of had like a little, you know, postcard size window into it. And we were like, whatever, kind of. I mean, we did, you know, just things that to us indicated we weren't as serious about it. We just didn't understand the stakes. And in our case, management acted a certain way and we reacted and we realized that we had to do things. And what a lot of people, their situation is their job is like bad, but it's like not that bad. So they're like kind of whatever, you know? And, you know, to what Chris was saying is that we've grown up in an era where, you know, maybe our parents were in unions, but our friends aren't really in unions. And the people who are 10 years older than us are not in unions. So we don't have the social experience of being like, well, should I go to college or should I just join the union? Which is kind of my dad's experience, you know, and he did go to college, but he got a job with the city and it was a union job and that was a good opportunity. Whereas I wasn't even thinking about that. And I've thought about that a lot, that we haven't even done that. So what we're doing now is we're just really educating ourselves and our generation.
Why did we lose that consciousness in high school and in college? Why wasn't there anybody along the way being like, you could consider this.
Yeah,
like,
no, I mean,
there's
like,
definitely a program of vilifying unions.
They were smashed.
That's huge.
And we're... The thing... I mean, I've come up against that with us, and in myself, too. And your own... You sort of fear, like, oh, you hear, like, oh, the unions got greedy or something, and, like, or the unions... Whatever, there's this idea that...
Yeah, like, the union man is lazy.
Yeah, or the idea that they somehow don't deserve... It's like, oh, they have this amazing health care and it's making the corporation go bankrupt. You know, GM is going bankrupt
they blame the union
because they have to take care of the laborers. That it's like, well,
that they were going to like open fire on.
Right.
Yeah.
It's totally insane.
But I mean, think about this. The reason why we were able to unionize at MoMA and at PS1 as well is because they are tied to this building.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what the problem with unionizing for gallery workers is that the gallery would just close down and move, and they would just
anywhere in the world.
But and that's, are, you know, that happens in journalism. It happened at DNA Info and happened at Gothamist. Yeah. And it can, that's the problem with unionizing
some of the galleries are putting down some pretty big roots though. Because the money has gotten so big. Like there's
And they'll be bigger than ever before. And both Gagosian and David Zwirner will be, you know, in a few years.
Hauser and Wirth
will be these massive galleries that require, you know, even bigger full-time staffs that might unionize. But that, I don't think, has really been a possibility before.
Right.
So we've taken the chance to unionize at a place that is totally tied to its location. I mean, like, PS1 can't shut down and move somewhere else. They are that building. And so if MoMA really wanted to, they would shut it down, but it's kind of like, who cares? So we actually have an opportunity to go pretty far with this, whereas other people don't.
Yeah, well, and to expand especially the new museum, like that's it's getting so much press.
Yeah.
It's like it's doing like it's the perfect time.
Yeah,
to,
it's probably the best thing they could have done for the union is to kind of try and hire that union busting law firm.
Yeah, seriously, talk about backfiring.
Yeah. Yeah.
Holy crap.
Or at least taking this to a new level where people are even more and more conscious of it, more conscious of the possibilities. And we weren't even aware. I mean, we would love it if other places were unionized. I mean, it's only better for us. But we weren't even necessarily thinking about them unionizing. And for us, you know, it's better and better. the more places it unionize, and definitely museums. I mean, museums are ground zero for it because they have permanent staffs, investment in infrastructure and capital investments, and the employees are capital investments.
Also, they, you know, what we realized in the room and while negotiating is that they're like, okay, well, what is the industry standard, you know? And you look at different industry standards, and the industry standard for art handlers, whatever, is there's some places that pay very, very little, and they can bring down the industry standard for everybody. So like, it's sort of like we're all going to, like, work on these things together as, like, as an entire industry.
All rise tides together or whatever.
Yeah. Well, all boats float. Yeah.
Float up,
yeah. All the people are little boats.
All the people are boats.
But when you're negotiating the next contract, they'll be able to point to us, and we'll be able to point to them and be like, no, this is, like, and you guys, and they didn't go under, because, you know, they can be like, oh, we don't have any money, or we're not, you know, or everyone, we're not MoMA. Even MoMA says, we're not MoMA.
No. Meanwhile, they're making MoMA 3. Like, that's the thing that gets me with it.
But the crazy thing is that, you know, there really hasn't been an organized movement in art. Well, I mean, there's been many organized movements in art, but there isn't now an organized consciousness of, like, openly talking about what everyone else is making, you know, or at least now. Like, people have vague ideas, and I think it's becoming more and more established. And even in these negotiations, I think that, you know, management is like, oh, we, you know, we're comparing ourselves to, like, all these kind of, like, B-rated places, you know? And, like, we're like, no, we're comparing ourselves to the best. And they're like, no, we're more like these small places that have, like, a fraction of the square footage and have a fraction of the staff, and they're paying their people $20 an hour or something like that. We're like, no way. I mean, this place is amazing. We're doing a Bruce Nauman show. You've got to be kidding me. Yeah. You know? Get out of here. So for them placing themselves in that universe, I don't think that kind of thing has happened before necessarily. And, you know, especially when things get unionized, it's like these people at this institution get paid this and get paid that and the other thing. You know, it's all about the wages and what they should be and what they are and how to compare them.
Yeah. I mean, that's what, yeah. And when you negotiate, like, that's what you do. It's like industry standard. And then you have...
So we're really just establishing it now.
Right.
And there's that's almost the biggest thing about this.
Yeah, it's not even
a craft contract, you know?
Yeah. What is it a trade? Is, like, art handling a trade?
And what does it get paid?
Yeah.
And how do we get
sign up?
How do we get the conversation to go to the executives are getting
podcasting.
The unionized pod. We do want to unionize podcasting. That is definitely absolutely on the table, 100%. But what I wanted to say was, why is it never like the executives are getting paid too much? Why is it always pay you guys more?
I think it's the American
because they get to set their own rate. You know, if we got to set our own rate, we'd get paid.
Yeah,
a bunch of money.
Yeah,
and we never, and you know, like, we never show up to the office. Yeah. We'd also always be in California.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Or Europe, California or Europe.
They're useless.
Yeah,
and they get a
house. No, they're just elsewhere.
They're doing very useful things somewhere else.
They're making deals, the president.
Yeah,
that guy everyone likes. Sorry,
but it is good to just start thinking about. I guess this is like, I was like, oh, that's a lot of money when you hear about like a corporate parachute or something, but you never, I didn't necessarily like immediately think about every other person that wasn't paid that money. Like you're like, you're like, okay, $30 billion Jeff Bezos. So nobody needs more than a couple million bucks. So that's just like $29 billion that hit all of his, like, somebody's labor made that money for him.
Yeah, yeah.
Somebody, you know.
Yeah, totally.
He didn't do any. I mean, it was just I don't know, maybe pay the United Post, like, taxes need to go up on him and pay the post office, like, the people delivering the things.
Hire a lot more post office, build more post office.
Yeah, yeah. How is the post office, like, going bankrupt and Jeff Bezos has $60 billion?
And the lines are longer than ever. Like,
well, it seems like the way that we've structured society is that our understanding of like working models for humanity to carry on has been like shifted away from any kind of regulatory system that could make up a nation, and now we're just also having a time that is like unprecedented, where our government is shut down now for the longest shutdown yet, and we're seeing like capitalists as their own states.
Right.
And we're seeing like, oh, well, we have to make sure that these states are funded. Otherwise, like, how is anything going to continue? Like, you know, if the head of Google doesn't have enough money to like allocate funds amongst their own feudal state, then like perhaps many, many people will suffer, and it's up to them to decide how they want their laws to be enacted within their borders. And it's just like we're sort of losing the cohesion between these entities. And it's just sort of, it's like, well, there isn't really like a safeguard at that upper echelon. And I don't know.
I mean, it seems like that's always been the model for America. And there was this like little tiny blip in the 40s where like labor, or like the 30s, where things kind of took a turn. Things got so bad, and like they're like, okay, the little kids are like dying in the mines, so like maybe we should like do something. And there was mass protests and like a movement to right it a little bit, but I think it's just been a country based on a couple incredibly wealthy like capitalists that are basically running the state,
you're the president.
Like, it
kind
of makes sense because like it's a bunch of signifiers, right? It's like there is no country; it's all made up. So that's why the wall is so important, because it's just like signifying that this thing exists that like is actually just an illusion. It doesn't actually.
Yeah, so capitalism is just reifying the property.
Yeah,
and like to the whatever scale that is. But we should wrap up. We're almost at an hour, and I just wanted to give you guys the opportunity to plug any projects, your own work, anything you want. Like I know Rob, you mentioned you're a journalist. Do you have any articles people should check out?
I just wrote two articles that are pertinent to this.
Cool.
That I was very excited that came out. One came out January 2nd, the other one the 14th. The first one was a review of a book by Lewis Hyman, who's an economic historian at Cornell. He's kind of moderate, but it's a history of temp labor, from migrant labor to temp office workers to like high paid consultants. And it's interesting. It tracks the rise of unions, the fall of unions, and the replacement with temps. So I think it's really useful to understand that started in the 50s. So that's on LA Review of Books.
We'll link it in the show notes.
Thanks. And then I have another article that's a review of a book called Uberland. It's by Alex Rosenblatt, who is a technological sociologist, or ethnographer, I think she calls herself. And it's just about how it's about algorithmic management and what it's like to be managed by an algorithm. And my conclusion was,
it's great.
The book?
No, it's great
to be managed by it. Yeah. That it's actually, it's probably how people are going to be managed in the future. Right.
It's probably actually better than a lot of people.
It'll be kind of the same.
Yeah.
That's how they're managed. that's how they're managed in Neo-Yokio. We did an episode about Neo-Yokio. I'm just doing a callback.
Hey, management sucks.
Yeah.
I'll plug my noise rock album that I just released last month. A project called No Fan. We're on Spotify and all streaming services. And the No Fan Thank You Sleep.
Great.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Check it out.
And
I'll pass on the plug.
You didn't talk at all.
I know. I'm actually not here.
Yeah. You came for like the camaraderie and like just the vibes, and but it was an excellent conversation, and I really appreciate your guys' perspective, and especially after the recent news with New Museum, I think like people should know that there's you know, many efforts going on at once.
And we just started a Twitter handle, which I didn't mention. But
we did?
Yeah, we did. So
yeah,
things are moving fast.
Yeah, and you know, we're coming up on probably another negotiation, and maybe some other stuff will be happening. So if you want if you'd like to participate. We've had a couple of rallies at the museum, and they've been really good.
Yeah, they had the big rat, guys.
We had the big rat. So if you just keep your ears to the streets, well, we'd love
What's your Twitter handle?
It's Local30 MomaPS1.
We'll definitely post it and link it when we post the episode. Cool. And we have really extensive show. Our listeners know this, so we're really going to go all out, link you guys up, link your noise project. We'll do
Thank you.
Yeah.
Good old baby.
It was so nice to meet you all, and thank you for coming on our show in our tiny little baby studio. These like burly dudes playing with a plier this whole time. Like, it's very interesting.
Menacing.
I'm into it. Thanks so much again.
Thanks,
take care, everyone.
Thanks.
Yeah, let's have fun.
If you have an aeroplane that can fly the world and we can have a fantasy, it doesn't really matter if you drive a limousine. It really doesn't matter if you drive for galaxy. I really don't care if you just drive a truck. I don't care if you just drive a limousine. It doesn't really matter if you drive a Ferrari. I really don't care, cause I just love your company. Let's have fun. Let's have fun. Let's have fun. Let's have fun, let's have fun, let's have fun. Let's have fun, lots of fun, let's have fun.